You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And just above him, it's a bit like a university challenge, this. I've got you one above the other, Daniele Friberincini.
Thank you, Richard. Which university am I representing?
Coventry. And we've got Watford University at the bottom and Coventry at the top. Yeah. Fingers on your buzzers, please.
We've definitely offended several people already with that. But anyway, go on.
Lionel's got a darts board and a bike behind him on the wall. Just that.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says about Lionel.
It says I like cycling and darts.
It looks like the bike is flying towards the darts board.
It's
heading for the bullseye.
It's hanging up. It is. It's heading for treble one moment.
I'm so bad at darts, I'd be puncturing those tyres with my darts.
Yeah, you could win a speedboat there, Lionel. So many British cultural references here. Sorry, everyone in America and elsewhere. To apologise. How are you both? Are you well?
Yep, fine. Bearing up. It's becoming slightly worryingly normal, the situation. You know, it's starting to feel worryingly normal.
Daniel, you have been busy beavering away on the Giro, haven't you? I think you've found a calling here.
Yeah, well, I've been channeling my inner Vincenzo Torriani, and we've already talked about the fact that we are doing our own Giro, aren't we? Our Giro d'Italia in May. It's going to be a sort of festival of Italian cycling, all things Giro related, and we have got a route. We're going on a virtual journey, sort of e-podcasting. if there's such a thing, Richard, you're shushing me. Am I giving away too much here?
Not you. No, I've got a 3-year-old intruder here.
Oh, right, okay.
Coming into my office.
I've been designing the route, and it's sort of redacted route. There was a route, of course, that was unveiled at the end of last year for the Giro, the Grande Partenza in Hungary, and then you know, the journey up the Italian peninsula. We'll be visiting, virtually at least, some of the towns and some of the locations that were on that route. But, you know, we're adding a bit of a twist, or a few twists of our own.
I mean, there's a well-trodden path, isn't there, from journalism to race director. Christian Prudhomme is a former TV journalist, a bit like yourself, Daniel.
I haven't been sacked yet. I'm awaiting the call any day.
Sorry. is that something you could see yourself doing, maybe?
I'd love to do it. I did think, actually, and this was a painstaking job, designing the route. We'll, as I say, talk more about that and see, you know, whether I've done a good job or not later on. But it did remind me, I don't know if you chaps, when you were young lads in Watford and, you know, the Highlands, at the back of the class in school, I used to design football kits, golf courses. Never at that age, I wasn't really into cycling routes yet, but I felt myself being sucked back to those halcyon days of, you know, when your imagination would run wild and you'd come up with these fictional events and kits and lineups.
Well,
oh yeah,
for a weird, I know you did, Lionel, but we know all about some of your routes. but for a brief spell, there was a strange romanticism in the British time trial courses. You'll hate Daniel. And it was only a brief time in my teens when I was, you know, when you get into cycling, time trials are a brilliant way of just measuring your progress and your improvements. And the time trial courses all have strange kind of code names.
They're like Zwift for people without a computer. who couldn't afford a computer, yeah.
Exactly like that. And the names didn't correspond at all to the road names or anything like that. It was a secret code. And finding these routes or riding on roads that you thought might make a good time trial course was I got a lot of fun in that, actually.
I created an entire fictional Tour de France in 1988, writing out the stage reports and the full stage and general classification. It really challenging adding time together with a pen and paper is not easy. It took a whole summer holiday. From memory, Sean Kelly beat Robert Miller.
Oh, there's a surprise.
and Lionel Burney tested positive for probenecid, but got off on a technicality.
Indeed. There's no doping in my fantasy childhood Tour de France, Richard. It's clean as a whistle.
Anyway, what have we got coming up in today's podcast? We have, well, Francois Thomazeau after, don't know how he follows I Way to L, but he's back. He's back with another song this week. It's fantastic. And it's got a Dutch theme to it. We're gonna be looking back a little bit on last year's Amstel Gold Race and the win by Mathieu van der Poel, and more to the point, talking about van der Poel, and we'll hear a little bit of a brand new special that's out. That's called Van der Poel, and it's largely a visit that I made when you were allowed to visit people to Adrie van der Poel's house. Adrie is, of course, the father of Mathieu van der Poel. That's out today for Friends of the Podcast. We'll hear an extract from that. We'll hear from the Dutch journalist Raymond Kerkhoff, who has been covering cycling for many years, and he'll talk about all things Dutch cycling at the moment. We'll hear again from Larry Warbass in America, and a little bit from Jack Haig, the Michelin Scott rider as well.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
I'm Ian Childs, and I'm one of the founders of Kendal Cycle Club, and I'm now and still continue as the lead coach. I think it's because it's such a wide-ranging club, it's a social aspect that brings so many different types of riders together, from road, mountain bike, all the different disciplines, but just the real social impact that it has, and the amount of friends that have been made is just phenomenal.
A big thank you to our headline sponsor, iWalker, whose support helps to ensure that we can carry on as normal. And we heard there from Ian Childs of the Kendal Cycle Club, a founder of the Kendal Cycle Club, the club that is also supported by iWalker. The company remains 100% focused on their mission to provide customers with the finance they need to bridge cash flow gaps and make investments.
I was born in a valley of bricks, where the river runs high above the rooftops. I was waiting for the cars coming up late at night from the Dutch mountains. I was standing in the valley of rock, up to my belly in an early fog. I was looking for the road to a green painted house in the Dutch mountains. In the Dutch mountains. Mountains. Met a woman in the Valley of Stone. She was painting roses on the walls of her home. And the moon is a cone with the head of the queen of the Dutch mountains. Of the Dutch mountains. Mountains. I lost the button of my shirt today. It fell on the ground and it was running away. Like a train leading me back to the Dutch mountains. To the Dutch mountains. Mountains. Met a mirror on the back of a cow. He He was looking for the wind, but he didn't know how. I said, follow the clouds that look like a sheep in the Dutch mountains. In the Dutch mountains. Well, guys, this was a song by the Nits. It's a Dutch band. Lots of you, I suppose, never heard of the Nits. It was a great, great rock pop band from Holland in the 1980s, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s. Very, very good band. Not dissimilar to Crowded House or Squeeze. In a more Anglo-Saxon word. If you have a chance to check them out, they're all over YouTube and all over the place. I think they still exist, actually. And the Nits, my favorite album of theirs, is called Adieu Sweet Van Hoff. And there's lots of great songs of theirs. And I thought that In Dutch Mountains was absolutely suited to the Amstel Gold Race. And which is, of course, riding around all the hills, bumps, whatever you want to call them, moles around the Netherlands. Here you are. So that was the Nits. That was my songs for the week. My song for the week on the Cycling Podcast. And looking forward to the next one. Cheers, guys. Bye.
The Nits. Were you familiar with the oeuvre of the Nits, either of you?
No.
No, I did have a spell, and actually ongoing, a bit of an obsession with Dutch. You're familiar with Dutch style of music. I think they call it Levenslied, which is, it's basically the NAF songs that you hear. If you ever go to a Dutch national team football match, I went to the World Cup in 2006 in Nuremberg in Germany, and Holland were playing Portugal, and there was a stage set up in the square in Nuremberg, and these awful songs, the kind of songs we hear on Alpe d'Huez, Dutch Corner, Alpe d'Huez, artists like André Hazes, Walter Kroos, and I had a bit of an obsession with this for a while, and I still delight and amuse and disgust some of our Dutch colleagues by occasionally breaking out into a rendition of some of these songs.
Hard for Francois to do those acoustically, though, isn't it? Which is why, I was hoping he would do Gold by Spandau Ballet this week for the Amstel Gold Race, but again, probably trickier to do just with an acoustic guitar, no?
Yeah, and I like the authenticity of the Dutch flavour to that. That doesn't sound very kind of Europoppy at all. I quite liked it. I might go and discover a bit more about the band, a new one to me, but I enjoyed that song. Thanks, Francois, again.
I wonder whether he'll do any cycling-inspired band covers. I'm thinking the Delgados, Campag Veloset, two British bands from the 90s.
Abdou Japrov.
The thing about Francois.
Abdou
Japrov. Yeah, I mean, you can mention any band at all to Francois, and he knows the band. He knows his music, does Francois. The Delgados, of course, almost called Bernardino. They were going to be called Bernardino. Alan Woodward, the man behind the Delgados, big cycling fan. So anyway, that was Francois with a bit of a Dutch flavour, and it would have been the Amstel Gold Race this weekend. It's not a race that perhaps stands out in the calendar most years.
I was looking back at the list of results. I surprised myself that I'd never actually been to the Amstel Gold Race. I've been to Valkenburg several times. The Tour de France was there in 2006, finished over the top.
Stage win for Kessler?
Matthias Kessler, that's right, T-Mobile. The town was absolutely rocking that day. It was completely full. It was like a kind of sporting event meets Glastonbury, and the detritus afterwards down in the town, all the plastic beer glasses, was really quite something. I've been to ride around some of those roads a few times. The World Cyclocross Championships were there a couple of years ago, weren't they? Went over for that, but never actually been to the Amstel Gold Race. It kind of got lost. It was a sort of after the Lord Mayor's Show event through the 80s and 90s, wasn't it? It came after Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and until the Vuelta moved to its September slot, it often overlapped, didn't it? The Vuelta overlapped with the Amstel Gold Race. But then it seems to have kind of settled into a new and slightly more prestigious place on the calendar since moving in 2003. Swapping places with Liège-Bastogne-Liège means that Liège-Bastogne-Liège is kind of like the final classic of the spring. But as a result, Amstel Gold Race seems to be amplified a little bit as a result, rather than being sort of the consolation prize. It's a stepping stone on the way to Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
And it was certainly amplified last year with Van der Poel's win and the way that he won that race, which for a lot of people confirmed the talent, I suppose. I mentioned earlier on that I'd been to see Adrie Van der Poel, his father. He actually thought that his performance at the Tour of Flanders the previous week, 2 weeks earlier, had been more impressive from an athletic point of view. He didn't win that race, of course, but the performance at the Amstel Gold Race, when Julian Alaphilippe and Jakob Fuglsang were away and seemingly about to decide the race between them, and Van der Poel sort of towing a group along behind him and almost single-handedly bringing them back, it seemed, and then winning the sprint. Well, that was a finale to a race that, you know, few people had seen before, and it really did get people excited and talking about Van der Poel as this phenomenon. Let's hear a clip from the special. Here's me. We hear some commentary from the day. I have to say, Rob Hatch was at the top of his game that day as well. The commentary in the final few commentaries was absolutely outstanding. To match the performance. So here's a bit from Rob, a bit from Adrie Van Der Poel, that's Matthew's father. And we also hear from a Belgian journalist, Hans van de Vega, who has followed Van Der Poel very closely. We hear from him throughout this Friends special.
Okay, the Amstel, it was very special, because there almost everything he did wrong, but at the end it turned right. So what can you say? You know, you know, when he attacked, I said, stupid.
Smarter, he has to get smarter, because what he did in the Amstel Gold Race was stupid, but then still he won.
Look at this. Gorkai Zagirre and Mathieu van der Poel on the Hulpeberg. Mathieu van der Poel, again with such a distance to go, takes off on the attack, and Amstel Gold Race is alive and kicking.
But afterwards, I saw on the climb after where Fuglsang and Alaphilippe went, he wasn't that bad. He was only a little bit unlucky at the bottom. And then, okay, then we were always, I was there as I was supporting the team. And then I saw him at 25 kilometers from the finish, and he looked very, very fresh, but he was 1 minute behind. So, and then I yelled to him, the podium is still possible. Yeah, but what else can you say? and then, he became then, you won then this one.
There's the final turn. It's tail crosswind for the final K now, and it's Alaphilippe at the front. And they're about to be joined by a whole new group, and Van der Poel and company might do it yet. What an exceptional day. Here comes Kwiatkowski. Left-hand side hits the front, and he's right back in the game. How did they let them do this? 400 metres. Van der Poel behind. Clark with him. Schachmann, Balde, Madois. There's Lambrecht, Trentin, De Marchi and Mollema. But it's the front three we're occupying ourselves with at the moment. This still could be anybody's. We've had one breathless finish already today. We're going to have another now inside the final couple of hundred metres. It's Alaphilippe who takes up on the right-hand side. Look at Van der Poel going from behind, though. Look at Van der Poel on the left-hand side. Mathieu Van der Poel's going to do it. Mathieu Van der Poel. This is incredible. Has a home winner. It's Roy of the Rover stuff for Mathieu van der Poel.
But what I mean is, a lot of them, they were focusing on what he did in the Amstel. But I wrote the last couple of days some articles from sport directors who were in the race, and they all said, forget the Amstel. What he did in the Tour of Flanders was quite different and maybe not so special, because he didn't win. He said, but that was really riding with the bike.
I guess the question for a lot of people going into that race was how would he last the distance? And yeah, he was quite far back, you know, because he had a quite heavy crash, fought his way back, then attacked. And then, you know, I guess, again, when I said you're a badass rider, I guess that a kinder way or a more polite way of saying that is that you were very shrewd and canny and calculating and tactically very strong. At what point in his career did you have to stop yourself, you know, giving him a bollocking afterwards for getting the tactics wrong, even if he still won?
Well, we already did, eh? But you know, because in the Amstel, I was saying, so I was not that smart to do it. He said, yeah, but...
Well, it's hard to tell him that he's done it wrong when he's
won. Okay, but you know, also he was a little bit lucky, yeah?
Yeah.
It said, I did the attack. Okay, it was maybe it was not smart, but I hoped that some riders go with me. He said, but the climb afterwards, it was Alain Philippe who attacked, so the team of Lefebvre and Astana, they were quite nervous. And they had to do the last 40 kilometers with two, eh? So maybe that was the right plan afterwards. We never know. But you know, he I think when... That's for sure. When you are riding in the peloton, it's quite different than when you are looking at the television, you know? You see the riders. They are good, they are not good, or... So... Yeah, for me, it's no problem. He already won nice races with his way of racing, and for sure he's gonna lose also nice races with his way of racing.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by you, a community of cyclists playing fair and taking good care to save each other money on their bike insurance. Richard, you're a Lacca customer, aren't you? Have been for quite some time.
A bit over a year now since I got my new bike, yes. Not had any claims to make, and the premiums are pretty reasonable, and I'm very happy. And what I hear of Lacca's service is all very positive. But don't take my word from it. Let's hear from a Lacca customer who has unfortunately had to make a claim.
My name is Luis. I'm a keen cyclist. I'm 46 years old. I ride around 300 kilometers a week. I became a Lacca customer, I think, last year and a half. I was referred by a friend of mine, which was a Lacca customer, and he strongly advised me to take the Lacca insurance. As he said, they were very good with the customer service. And so I had actually two claims in 1 year. I crashed last year, a bad cry. I broke my collarbone, the bike, at some parts they were damaged, which I claim with the Lacca, and they were... excellent. I have no other word to describe that customer service and how they deal with the situation. I had everything fixed. I had a reply in 2 days, and it was all sorted with no issues at all. I was preparing for this for the Tour of Cambridge, which happened every year. Yeah, and I crashed on my own. It was no one's fault. I think the tension of the pedal wasn't tight enough, and I was putting some power down on the bike, and my foot came off, and I crashed. Both wheels were damaged. The frame was actually intact. It was pretty amazing. Yeah, so I got the wheels fixed. The helmet was completely broken, and I got that replaced as well. I just did a little video, which I uploaded to the website along with my claim, describing what happened. And I had a reply, I believe, next morning, very early morning, saying, yes, we're going to replace your helmet. If you can give us, I mean, how much will be for to fix the bike, which I had the shop to contact them. And they sorted out everything for me. I'm very, very satisfied customer. And I advise anyone who can hear this, Lacca, it's amazing. Amazing is the word I find at the moment.
Well, if that sounds like the sort of insurance you would like for your bikes and equipment, go to lakka.co.uk. That's Lakka, LAKA.co.uk. And you can get your quote in a few very easy steps.
So that was Audrey van der Poel and others on Matthew van der Poel's performance at the Amstel Gold Race last year. And I suppose one of the questions I was interested in with Audrey was that he was a very good rider in his day and won a lot of races and what tended to tick things off a list. He won the Tour of Flanders once. He won the Amstel Gold Race. He won San Sebastian. He did win a couple of stages of Tour de France. He was a very canny, very shrewd rider, very sort of tactically astute. And that's not something you could say of his son Matthew, in the sense that he, at the Tour of Flanders and at the Amstel Gold Race, he did things that you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to be able to do. And I was curious to ask Audrey about, you know, what does he, in their sort of debriefs, what does he say when he gets the tactics wrong but still wins? You can't really tell him off for that. So I was interested in that. But I was interested in the contrast between them as riders, and how much of Audrey van der Poel there is in Matthew and how much of Raymond Poulidor, his grandfather, there is in Matthew van der Poel.
What did you make of Audrey van der Poel? You went to visit him. I gather he's still in the same house he's been in many years, in Capellen, right near the border, actually in Belgium, but very close to the border with the Netherlands.
I found him a lot warmer than I expected, because I did remember him as a rider and had this impression of him as quite a dour sort of character. Very serious and not a rider that I particularly warmed to when he was competing. But I find him quite warm and quite open. And, I don't know Matthew van der Poel very well at all. Haven't interviewed him. And it was interesting speaking to Hans van der Vega, the Belgian journalist, who has followed him really, really closely, but prefers to observe him than to speak to him. There's almost more to say about him than to extract from him in conversation. He's that sort of phenomenon, isn't he, Matthew van der Poel? But yeah, Audrey I found very, very open and interesting and fascinating on the subject of his son, the phenomenon.
I think, you talk there about that his sort of modus operandi, van der Poel's modus operandi, and, more than the results themselves, the style in which he won Amstel Gold last year and finished fourth in Flanders, but yeah, everything really in his past and in his background and the way he's got to this point suggests to me that there's been a very deliberate choice by Audrey van der Poel and a real sort of roadmap that he came up with when van der Poel really started cycling or started taking cycling seriously, to make sure that he broke through or didn't get stuck in these dogmas, these kind of ossified patterns in professional cycling that we see in road cycling. You know, the idea that every team has a leader and that, you know, you work for the leader until the last whatever, whether it's the last 20 kilometers, the last climb or the sprint. Because, you know, for a start, van der Poel didn't join the Rabobank setup when he was a teenager. He could have joined the Rabobank setup. And, you know, the Rabobank setup, it's depending on who you are, it's either held up as this brilliant example of how you develop young riders, or by a lot of Dutch journalists and Dutch commentators, people involved in Dutch cycling, as a sort of cautionary tale, because a lot of the riders who went through that system, they got accustomed to this fantastic, you know, level of support and attention, and, you know, they live like pros really from their late teens, and a lot of commentators have said that they then suffered as a consequence of that, because they weren't able to improvise as well, or they were spoiled and so forth and so on. Anyway, van der Poel decided early on that he didn't want his son to be part of that, because he wanted it to be more like a game for him. He wanted him to be trying to win every race, not riding for a leader. And then you look at the sort of off-road disciplines where, again, there's much more of an element of sort of play. Mountain biking, I know he came to mountain biking very late, only I think 2016 he rode mountain bike races for the first time, but cyclocross as well. And again, the emphasis there is very much on, well, it's, you know, they're individual disciplines, and you know, it's about sort of finding a way to win on your own. So everything he's done has created this sort of, you can call it a phenomenon or a freak or whatever, who does ride in a different way from most professionals.
And the challenge for him, they all say, including his manager Christophe Roodhoofd, who with his brother Philippe Roodhoofd, they've looked after Van der Poel since he was 15, with Adri quite closely involved. I was reminded a little bit of Andy Murray and Judy Murray, in the tennis player, in the sense that Adri is clearly very involved in his son's career, but he's not sort of directly managing him. He's at a distance, he's at a slight remove. So he's involved, he's invested in it, but he's not sort of managing the minute details. That's very much down to Philippe, who looks after the business side, and Christophe, who looks after the sporting side. So he seems to have quite a good balance in there, as far as I could tell. But yeah, I mean, one of his big challenges, they all say, is boredom. And he gets very bored in the early stages of road races. And one of his... he's constantly looking for guys to talk to in the peloton, and the big Stijn Vandenberg is one of his favorite go-to guys, the AG2R rider. But
Alaphilippe, they talk as well. A lot about, he's very close to Alaphilippe.
Yeah, they talk, right. Well, they talk a lot about cars, but the problem is Vandenberg keeps getting called up to work quite early in races, so he misses his pal. So he struggles with the boredom of that. And I think, you know, the in a mountain bike race, a cyclocross race, the race is on from the gun, and there isn't that waiting, that need for patience that you do need in a 250-kilometer road race.
I think that Matthew van der Poel's career is kind of mirroring, in a way, Adri van der Poel's career, because van der Poel Senior didn't get pigeonholed as one particular thing. He had a very varied career. Richard, you described it as kind of ticking off race victories, and there looks to be an element of that. When you look back at how he broke through, he was in the Netherlands team at the Olympic Games in 1980, rode the road race, and was the first rider who wasn't from behind the Iron Curtain in that race. He finished seventh. Everyone ahead of him was either from the Soviet Union, Poland, or East Germany. And the following year, he turned pro and made a kind of instant impact, finishing second overall at Paris-Nice. But that was kind of overshadowed a bit by Stephen Roach, who was also a first-year pro and won the race. Van der Poel then went on and finished second in Flèche Wallonne. And over the next, he had a very long career, but certainly over the next decade, he won one edition of a lot of the classics, one Tour of Flanders, one Liège-Bastogne-Liège, one Amstel Gold, classics, Classica de San Sebastian, Paris-Brussels, Paris-Tour, the Championship of Zurich. He dabbled at the Tour de France as a bit of a bunch sprinter, never kind of the super fastest, but a tough person to beat on his day. Won a couple of stages. I think
won a criterium in Glasgow in 1992.
Put a kilt on
it. Did you race in that?
I did. I mean, that's how the episode starts.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to that. I think Van der Poel won the last split stage in the Tour de France that wasn't on the opening weekend with the team time trial in the afternoon. They had a sort of 35-kilometre or 38-kilometre, I think it was, stage from, it finished in Po, so it was just a race from the gun, and then they did another 200-kilometre stage in the afternoon, but Van der Poel won the short morning stage, and of course was a fixture on the cyclocross circuit every winter.
Well,
and
famously only later took him... on, Lionel, he came to cyclocross late in his career. I was surprised to learn that it wasn't something he'd sort of grown up with.
Yeah, from about the early 90s, wasn't it? But he, of course, he had a very long career. He was still racing at 41, and the story of his cyclocross career was just how every year he was there or thereabouts in the World Cup. He was multiple champion in the Netherlands, but it took him until 1996 when he was really getting, solidly veteran status by then. That was the first time and only time that he won the world title on in cyclocross, wasn't it? So when you look at Matthew van der Poel's talent and his incredible spring last year and then try and tally that up with his intention to race the mountain bikes at the Olympic Games, on the one hand, it's kind of an it's rather an incongruous thing to still be aiming for. But when you look at what his father did, it makes a little bit more sense, maybe.
I understand that, you know, with the change to things this year and the Olympic Games moving back a year, he, you know, if we do get road racing, he will be all guns blazing for to try and get in the biggest races, obviously. And the team had a wild card at Piru Bay this year, but they're really trying now for a ride at the Tour de France if that happens. And who knows what that would look like or how that would be acquired. You know, some teams are already in danger of going out of business. You don't know what the landscape's going to look like, but that apparently would become his main goal for 2020, would be to get a ride at the Tour de France.
I think, you know, we talked last year about one of the dangers for him was the weight of the hype and the expectation. And you know, it seemed to have a different pitch than it usually does for young riders, you know, who are successful very quickly. I mean, you know, we saw it with Peter Sagan. Peter Sagan was another rider who, well, similar to Van der Poel in some ways, seemed not just to be superior, but different. He seemed to have a different attitude to cycling, a different way of racing. And we see that, I think, even more with Van der Poel. And I think that's one of the most exciting things you ever see in sport. And it's so rare that someone comes along who not only looks superior to what there is at that moment, but it also looks as though they're sort of shifting a paradigm. I mean, I was trying to think of examples of this in other sports, and I was sort of thinking of the 1996 Cricket World Cup when the Sri Lankans, I think it was Jayasuriya and Kalawitana, the pinch hitters. No one had sort of, you know, slogged the way they did at the start of innings before, and it seemed that it was destined to change the sport, and it did change the sport. And then, you know, even Usain Bolt, Rich, someone who you've written a book about, it wasn't just the fact that, you know, the times that he was producing, but the fact that he looked so different to anything people had seen before. And I think that was the case, and that's one of the reasons why people got so excited about Van der Poel. Both tactically, he was doing different things, and just, you know, the sort of level of aggression and sort of spontaneity on a bike created this hope that, and this expectation that he was going to be not just a sort of era-defining rider, but a seminal rider, a rider who would maybe change the way we looked at the sport. And I think that's, you know, it's probably an impossible burden to bear. I think last year when he won Amstel Gold, I was sort of saying that if he went on to have the same career as the best classics rider of this generation, which is Philippe Gilbert, then I felt that people would almost be disappointed, because they almost expect more from him than that, which seems a ridiculous thing to say. But again, it's a tough thing for him to live with.
A point you've made about Sagan, though, Daniel, is that it's his impact, his legacy is not going to just be his results. It's also the performances and the show. And I think we could probably say the same of Mathieu van der Poel, perhaps. I mean, you know, to some of us, it doesn't make a lot of sense that he spreads himself so thinly, especially targeting mountain biking against riders for whom, you know, Olympic Games will be their single focus for the year and the single peak, whereas he's aiming for several different peaks. And, you know, again, if those of us who don't follow mountain biking that closely watch him go to Olympic Games and not win a gold medal, we'll think, well, that was a waste of time. But there's more to it than that. And I think, again, one of the points that a lot of people around him make is that his appeal to fans and to sponsors, in particular his bike sponsor Canyon, is that it's just in the attempt almost. It's in the journey rather than the destination that people are interested, you know. And for him personally, it's obviously it keeps him interested and stimulated, but for, you know, the fan base that he can reach is much bigger, much broader as a result of the fact that he's targeting so many different things.
Well, yeah, you mentioned him keeping stimulated, keeping interested. It's the thing that characterised both his Tour of Flanders, where he finished fourth, and the Amstel Gold Race, was that he was in difficulty, wasn't he? He was in a position of disadvantage at Flanders. He bunny hopped a curb.
Classic.
To try and get back into position, punctured, and then, you know, basically chased.
Classic
and
example.
And the sight of him.
Sorry, Nate, but a classic example of that phenomenon we discussed a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember who we were referring to, but
Alaphilippe stopping for a wee before the Cipressa.
Sanremo. Yeah, and we've seen it many, many times.
That boost of kind of adrenaline, something just to mentally make somebody realise that this is now do or die. This is I make the effort here and I race or not, rather than sitting in. I think, you know, the World Championships was a kind of a cold slap in the face perhaps for Van der Poel, because he rode a much more conventional race and it blew up for him when it really mattered. He ran out of gas, probably because of the cold and the wet, but he didn't, you know, he didn't sort of race in quite the same flamboyant sort of way. It wasn't that sort of day. There wasn't the opportunity to do so. But the thing that really sticks in the mind, and I suppose when I sort of analyse what I said about the Amstel Gold Race last year, it was almost like trick shot cycling, wasn't it? And I couldn't really place it in a context. It was clearly an amazing comeback, an amazing feat. You know, he was pretty much out of the race and then suddenly he was at the front and winning. But it felt almost sort of freakish in that sense. It didn't feel like a conventional performance that you could assess in a conventional way, and perhaps that, certainly from my point of view, that's perhaps what kind of threw me off a little bit. But with a little bit of distance and looking back on his whole campaign, which was an incredible spring of first and fourth places spread over about 3 weeks, it was
I would say Brabantse Peel as well was another race where he was phenomenal.
He crashed in that as well, didn't he, and came back to win, is that right?
Well, I was there and I don't remember him crashing. Oh. You could well be right, but just the mixture of riders that he was with in the finale and still managing to win, from guys like Michael Matthews, Tim Wellens, another phenomenal performance.
Napalm, another difference with the World Championships was that was a rare occasion for him so far, and not to belittle the work that his teammates have done in races thus far and do for him and teammates, but that was a rare occasion where he had big name riders working for him, and he had the whole sort of apparatus that had been created for him to do well at that World Championships. And you know, we talk a lot, we've often talked about the sort of physiological legacy of cyclocross racing and mountain bike racing, and how that can be very, very beneficial for guys who turn to the road, particularly early in their career. And we've sort of noticed and talked about before how often they've plateaued actually after a couple of years. But you know, I think from a tactical point of view as well, the there is a legacy of coming from those worlds, and again, not being sort of mummified in team tactics, essentially.
Just to correct myself, the crash that I was thinking of was just before his incredible run of results in the spring races. He crashed out of Nokera Cursa, didn't he? And basically came back from that to win the Grand Prix Denain a few days later, and then he was off and running from there. So no, he didn't crash in Brabantse Peel.
But shall we get a slightly wider Dutch perspective? I spoke to Raymond Kerkhoffs the other day, a Dutch journalist, been covering cycling for many years. I want to speak to him about the Amstel Gold Race, about what might happen to it this year given its postponement, and about some of the other Jumbo Visma, what's the latest for them, and their star man Tom Dumoulin as well. So here is Raymond. Are there contingency plans for Amstel Gold Race? Is there talk of trying to hold it later in the year?
Yeah, I talked with the organizer, Leo van Vliet, and he tries to organize it somewhere in September, maybe the end of August. They hope to find a place at the UCI calendar. But first they have to wait what the UCI is going to do, and first waiting what the hill situation in Europe will be around that time. But they are very positive that they still can organize an Amstel Gold Race later in the year.
And how important is that? I mean, is it an event that really needs to be held, or could it skip a year and come back next year?
I think it's not directly that the event will quit when it's not held this year, because the owner of the Amstel Gold Race is the Heineken Brewery, so that's a really big multinational, and they have a lot of money, and the Amstel Gold Race is good publicity already for more than 50 years for them. But
that they try to organize it because it's better for the history when you continue also with a 2020 edition.
And Raymond, I spoke to you before about Jan Raas, prolific winner of Mr. Amstel Gold Race, I guess you could call him. But he has just sort of disappeared from Dutch cycling. What's the last you heard from or of Jan Raas?
Yeah, he quit cycling in 2003. The last time he was in the cycle race was at the start of the second stage of the Tour de France in Düsseldorf. He was then invited by his friend Hilaire van der Schuren, who is team director of Duranti Group. But Raas doesn't want to have contact with people in cycling, and he doesn't want to get in publicity. He still gave one interview with an old journalist, Wilver Hazen, only about the history of the Amstel Gold Race for the 50th edition. But with other journalists, he don't talk, and he don't want to have contact with many people, because I know old riders from him who were on his team and who were teammates of him. They tried to visit him in Zeeland at his living, but he refused to let them in. So he definitely has closed the door for cycling.
He's got quite a story to tell, hasn't he? Or he would have if he wanted to tell it.
Yeah, I think absolutely. Because when we go back to the 80s, he was one of the best classics riders. And also after, he was one of the best team leaders we had. And he was the man who brought in Rabobank in cycling. Until 2002, he was the manager of the Rabobank cycling plan, and he was also the initiator of that plan.
Sorry, Raymond, I'm being invaded here by my three-year-old boy. I do apologize. he wants to play with his papa, but his papa's got to do some work. Sorry, Maxime.
No problem.
Has he ever written a book or anything, Jan Raas, or not?
Yeah, there's written one book by Fled van Slochteren. But Raas didn't want to work with it. He don't want to say also much about how he quit Rabobank. I wrote a story for the Telegraph in 2003 about that, because the direction of the bank invited me after there were some troubles with Raas and the Dutch media. And then they showed me some files with history about Raas, and they say they were building files that they could quit him. And I made a story about it. And 2 months later, we get the press release that Raas and Rabobank will go their own way, and that Raas quit the Rabobank cycling plan.
So he wasn't very pleased with you, was he, Jan Raas?
No, he still wasn't, because I tried to speak with him in Düsseldorf and he was at the Tour de France, and then he refused to speak with me, and he still is angry at me. I don't know why. Sometimes the messenger is always the bad guy, but at that moment, people of Rabobank showed me files which they built up with bad histories of Raas. And that was, for me, a reason to make a story about it. Mm. Because if I didn't write about it, then they would invite another cycling journalist who would write that story.
I mean, you mentioned his history in the 80s and so on. I guess for a lot of people, the rivalry with Peter Post was a great story, wasn't it? He rode for his team, obviously, and then went off and set up his own team. And the rivalry between those teams was one of the great subplots of the 80s and the 90s, certainly.
Yeah, they were always in a big fight. I was talking also with a Dutch television program about the history of the Amstel Gold Race. And we can remember 1991 when Frans Maassen won the Amstel Gold Race. But it was in a sprint with Maurizio Fondries. Maas was riding at that moment for Buckler, the team from Jan Raas, and Fondries was riding for Panasonic. That was the team of Peter Post. And maybe you can remember the sprint that Maassen went a little bit from the left to the middle of the road. And after the finish, there were big fights between Raas and Post. that Massa went too far from his line and that he should be disqualified. And that was also one of the points that the war between Ras and Post gets on fire.
And we saw it at the Tour de France as well, of course. I think Franz Massen again and Marc Sargeant, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can remember. I don't know exactly which year, but then they refused to work together. And otherwise, one of the two would absolutely have won the stage. But now that they were just looking to each other, and it was a blame for cycling. And I can remember that the next day there was a meeting that Jean-Marie Leblanc asked Jan Raas and Peter Post to visit him in the Village des Parts. Mm. And there they have to apologize and they have to say that that never can happen again, because this was really bad advertising for cycling.
Mm. And just finally, Raymond, I mean, also on Dutch cycling, Jumbo Visma, of course, came into this year with huge ambitions around, you know, their leaders, and Tom Dumoulin in particular, from a Dutch point of view, coming back from injury. You know, a lot of teams in reportedly in trouble and questions about their futures. How is that team holding up? I'm guessing that a supermarket sponsor is probably a little bit more secure at the moment than some of the other sponsors.
Yes, we in the Netherlands, we didn't hear anything about having problems with the team sponsoring or that the riders have to bring back their salary. Of course, Jumbo is a supermarket, and we know that the last week the supermarkets did it really well. And the second sponsor is Visma, and they are working in automatization of
payments.
Of payments. So that's also something which continues and which is not directly hidden by this Corona crisis. So those companies are not a problem, and I think that is good for the team Jumbo-Visma at this moment. And I talked with Richard Pluggen about this, but he still hasn't heard anything from the sponsors about this subject.
And Tom Dumoulin, is he at home in Maastricht, and is he back to full fitness and training as best as he can?
Yeah, Tom is living 3 km away from Maastricht, and that's just in kind of just in Belgium. I think that 20 meters from his house, the frontier is the border is directly, and it's at this moment it is forbidden for people who live in Belgium to visit the Netherlands. So for him, it's not an easy way to come to the Netherlands, but he's still training here sometimes. And his condition is good. He had a really good winter, but then he had the problems in his stomach with the parasite. That was the reason why he couldn't do the Valencia Tour and later the Tirreno and Milan San Remo. But then he had for 10 days an antibiotica.
Antibiotics, yeah.
Yes, and after that, the condition is really well, but he becomes a little bit frustrated that he still can do races, because his last race is already the Dauphiné Libéré from last year. Mm. So he is missing maybe more than a year of competition. Mm. But if you look to the other leaders of Rabobank, Primoz Roglic and Steven Kruiswijk also didn't do one race in 2020. So will be the difference if you can race in July, if you didn't do for 8 or 9 months in no race or 1 year? So I think that it is not a really big problem, I think.
I like how you still call the team Rabobank there, Raymond.
I called it Rabobank?
Yeah.
Okay.
Old habits die hard.
Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Big thanks to Science and Sport for their continuing support of the Cycling Podcast and their support of you. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now, Science and Sport are also doing their bit to support the community and the food industry at the moment. As a nutrition company, they've used their capabilities to create a specially formulated complete meal solution, providing essential nutrients. For every tub of complete meal solutions sold, Science and Sport will donate an extra tub on your behalf to their charity partners to help those in need. You can also choose to donate your purchase tub to those most in need at this challenging time, and Science and Sport will match that and donate a second tub. As an initial donation, Science and Sport have provided £100,000 worth of products to their partner charities, Fair Share and Heroes, and different hospitals in the UK as well. Go to scienceandsport.com to see more information about this initiative.
Can't believe we got half an hour into this and I haven't told my Matthew van der Poel talent spotting anecdote. Told it so many times.
Don't worry, that's in the Friends special, Lionel. Excellent, don't you worry.
Excellent. I hope there's a big credit for me spotting his talent 20 years ago.
I mean, the van der Poel family remain very, very grateful. That's all I can say.
So talking about the precocity, was it precocity or precociousness? We heard from Raymond Kirkhoffs there, a man who covered the Tour de France when he was 16.
Wow.
I mean, even more precocious than you.
4 years, beats me by 4 years.
Was he wearing short trousers? I'm assuming he was, because it's quite warm at the Tour de France, isn't it? Usually. Often people wear short trousers. Something Francois frowns upon, people wearing shorts at the Tour.
The French generally, no? It's, trousers, shirts and ties.
Oh, well. Just on Amstel Gold, is it the longest standing continuous title sponsorship in men's professional cycling? I think it must be, no? It's founded in 1966, was it?
Talk about asking us a question that you know we won't know the answer to.
and that I already know the answer to because I've looked it up. I think it must
nice
be.
One.
Het Volk / Het Nieuwsblad is obviously longer standing, I guess, but hasn't got the same name now. Obviously, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad took over, the Het Nieuwsblad newspaper took over the Het Volk newspaper, didn't it? I'm just looking up other races that have got prominent, title sponsorship that actually defines the race. And the only other one that I could think of was the Grand Prix West France, sponsored by the newspaper. But that's only something that started in the late 80s, I think. The Cyclassics Cup in Hamburg was sponsored by an electricity company first, and then Vattenfall, another electricity company, and now EuroEyes, I think. And the Eneco Tour, now the Binkbank Tour. But the Amstel Gold Race, I think, must be the... If anyone out there knows, someone will know, they'll come up with another race. But I can't think of as high-profile a race that is so strongly defined by its title sponsor.
And Raymond mentioned there, or I asked him about Jan Raas, who's won 5 Amstel Gold races and for many years ran the Rabobank team, brought Rabobank into cycling, but has disappeared from cycling. Raymond mentioned there the 1991 race where the kind of rivalry between Jan Raas and Peter Post came to a head at the finish. Frans Maassen and Maurizio Fondriest were sprinting for that. If you want to look that up, it's on YouTube. It's an incredible sprint because Maassen takes Fondriest one way across the road and then the other way across the road, and it doesn't get penalised. That set up a very famous stage in the Tour de France later that year. Again, those two teams, by that point, they were Buckler. That was before Rabobank came in, and Panasonic, run by the great rivals Raas and Post. And they refused to let their riders work with each other in breakaways. And on this occasion, they were away with Jean-Claude Colotti at the Tour de France, Marc Saint-Jean and Frans Maassen. And they were ordered, Maassen was ordered not to work with Saint-Jean. So they stopped working with each other, and Colotti took off 30 kilometres to go, won the stage, and then was almost disqualified from winning the stage for his celebration on the finishing straight, which would have been quite funny. Frans Maassen, does anybody know Frans Maassen's full name? He's still a sports director at Jumbo-Visma these days.
Talk about asking a question name to which you know the answer and you know that we won't be able to remember
I bet Daniel knows the answer.
Franciscus
Albertus Antonius Johannes Maassen.
Wow.
France, wow. For short.
Wow. The Amstel Gold Race, sorry, Daniel, just that period from 77 to 91, 12 home wins for the Netherlands and only 3 foreign wins. It really was a home fixture. I quite like the fact that that 91 race at Massen won, he was riding for the Buckler team, as you mentioned, low alcohol or no alcohol beer, winning the Amstel race. Obviously, that is a beer with alcohol in. But I think they both were and certainly are now brewed by the same parent company, aren't they? Heineken. I'm getting into an area I don't fully know here. But a non-alcoholic beer sponsor winning the Amstel Gold Race. And my one question for you, Daniel, was how do they get round it when broadcasting the race in France with the rule about alcohol sponsors and sport?
That is a very good question.
Do they call it just the gold race?
No, they don't. Or the race? But that is a very good question. I suspect that the law, the loi Evin, is called, governing alcohol so advertising, it only governs events that take place on French soil. I would suggest. But Dutch beer is it's a bit of a cultural, well, no man's land, isn't it? Dutch beer,
sort of fizzy chemicals. No disrespect.
Always baffled me that they don't produce better beer than the Dutch. But just on Jan Raas, one of cycling's great hermits, isn't he? Along with Charlie Gall. I've got a Charlie Gall story that I'm going to say for the Giro. Another one of Daniel bumps into. Chance encounters. even though he's dead.
Wandering in the Ardennes, well, one thing, were you?
I will tell you this story during the Giro. But yeah, Jan Raas, a great cycling hermit, as Raymond said, sort of disappeared off the radar. I actually interviewed him shortly. I didn't realise this at the time, but this must have been a few months before he sort of removed himself from the public eye. But we were doing a feature on Amstel Gold Race for Pro Cycling Magazine, and I managed to get in touch with him, and he set me a sort of an impossible, unsolvable treasure hunt to try to speak to him, and I involved me sort of calling him every fourth day for a month, and you know, giving him the password, and then you know, guessing the name of his third cat, and he basically didn't want to speak to me, but I think I did manage to extract a few words from him, but sort of grunted, barked down the phone about Amstel Gold.
I had a similar experience with Peter Post, his great rival, when I phoned up to interview him, and he just hung up on me. But I did write about this in my book Etap, and I spoke to Hilaire van der Schuren, who runs the Wanty team, and he at the time was Jan Raas's assistant. And the tour was so angry after that Tour de France stage I mentioned, where Sargeant and Masson were ordered not to work with each other, that they got a reprimand, and van der Schuren told me that there was a meeting that night in the woods, in the middle of the woods, between the team's hotels in the middle of France. There was no light. It was at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was Peter Poss, Jan Raas, Walter Plankert and me. And at 1:45, it was finished and everything was okay. I said, did that mean... he said, it was a civil meeting. There was no anger and there was peace after that. I said, was that permanent peace? He said, for a few days, then it was back to normal.
I can't imagine Marc Sargeant ever refusing to work for anyone. I mean, if you sort of tried to pick a fight with Marc Sargeant, he'd, you know, probably bring you some cucumber sandwiches and a serviette.
He'd lace up your boxing gloves for you, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
sorry to bang on about these behind-the-scenes Tour of Flanders films, but the 2019 one is just out. And Sargeant features in all of them, and with Herman Frison, his sports director, and that he comes across again just a very sort of mild mannered, easygoing guy, those films kind of just confirm
another Belgian
that.
I think we've covered this before, another Belgian with a great answer phone message, and like Patrick Lefebvre, as mentioned before, this seems to be a thing in Belgium that you just leave your name in such a way that suggests you are actually on the end of the line. So you call Patrick Lefebvre and he's not there, and he just says, Patrick Lefebvre. And you said, well, hi, Patrick, I'm just calling. And then you realise, and Marc Sargeant is the same. You call him up and he's, Marc Sargeant. Oh, hi, Mark. I'm just calling on behalf of the cycling podcast. And yeah, very embarrassing.
Please leave your message after the beep.
Just on Dutch cycling, I don't know whether you guys know anything about this, but the kind of the idea that the Dutch would rather ensure that a Dutch person won, it kind of goes against the grain with the post-RAS anecdotes that you've got there, Richard. But I do remember the story of the 87 Amstel Gold Race won by Joep Zoetemelk, who was, I think, 40 by then. He'd won the world title a couple of years before, and I think 87 was his.
I think he was 40 when he won the tour in. No, sorry, he was 40 in 1980, I think. Oh, I might be wrong. Sorry, Nate. No,
I think he was 40 in 87, I think. Anyway, he was knocking on a bit. But Malcolm Elliott got in a break with three Dutchmen, and his story of that day, it was that basically the three Dutchmen made absolutely certain that they didn't get beaten by a Brit. And Malcolm tried to cover a couple of moves by Stephen Rooks and Turn Van Vliet, but then when Zoetemelk went, that was it. Job done. Elliott did finish third, but I think that do they get quite criticised if a group of Dutch riders all work each other over and then a foreigner wins? I don't know. Maybe that's me just sort of having absorbed sort of books and magazine features from the 80s when that was kind of the narrative that we were brought up on, I guess.
Hey, guys. You're here in lockdown with Larry. Just stopped on the side of the road on today's 6-hour ride. The sun's out, so I'm trying to take advantage. Not that warm, probably about 5 degrees, but it's at least a pretty day. So I'm exploring some new roads that I probably haven't ridden on in 20 years. Well, okay, maybe that's an exaggeration, but 15. So, yeah, it's pretty cool just to change it up a bit from the stuff I usually do. So I never see these roads when I'm home, just because never home for that long. So I stick to my usual routes. And, yeah, but for those jealous of me getting to ride outside, wouldn't probably have been so jealous of me riding in the snow yesterday. So got snowed on my 0-degree ride yesterday. But I made it through. It was only a couple hours with some effort. So yeah, just trying to make do where I can. I'm actually riding alone, so the cycling podcast has been keeping me company. Almost finished with this past week's episode. And, yeah, I just found it interesting and, you know, listening to Richard and the guys talking about, I guess, you know, trying to start a discussion on, you know, whether no one should be able to ride outside or who should be able to ride outside or what the situation should be. And, you know, I definitely think everyone just has to listen to their local authorities because, you know, you follow the laws in the country you're in. So, you know, just because people are forbidden to chew gum in Singapore doesn't mean, you know, we can chew our gum anywhere else in the world. So, you know, it's just like with any other law and any other situation, you follow your own country's laws and guidelines. And I think that's what we have to do, you know, to the best of our abilities. So, you know, hopefully our governments are making the right decisions for wherever you are, and I guess that's how we have to go about it. And yeah, in regards to me being from Texas, it is pretty funny because I'm about as far from Texas as could possibly be. But yeah, I'll never forget the first time I heard that was at the Vuelta after party in maybe 2016, I think. Daniel and I ended up at the same place after the race, and it was probably 1-2 in the morning, and he came up to talk to me about numerous things, but one of them was me being from Texas, which was pretty funny and a good laugh because I'm literally from as far north as you can get in the U.S., so no, not from Texas, but maybe I do have a little bit of a drawl in my voice. Cool. Well, hope you guys have a good one, and I'll check in soon. Ciao.
Well, Larry Warbass there with his regular dispatch from not Texas, as he He reprimanded you there, Daniel. Lazy journalist. Lazy journalism.
I think maybe. I mean, I think
for somebody who's plotting a Giro route, Daniel, your grasp on geography when it doesn't directly interest you is shocking.
I think maybe I was mixing him up with Lawson Craddock.
Of course,
I'd never mix up their time. I'd never mix up their time trial results.
Well, yeah. I mean, they've both got Christian names that begin with L. That's about it, really. I think they're not really very similar. I don't think Lawson Craddock and Larry Warbass. Anyway, thanks, Larry, for sending us in your latest dispatch. And still waiting for photographs, Larry. You're obviously listening to the podcast, so maybe I'll have more success asking you for photographs this way than by sending you another WhatsApp message.
What sort of photographs do you want?
Training setup, that kind of thing. It's her, you know, Jonathan Rose asking for photographs of Larry in lockdown. Send them in, Larry, when you get a moment. He needed to tidy up first. Fair enough. Lionel hasn't bothered. Anyway.
Oh, come off it. That's really out of order. You can see the bike is hung on the hook. The my cycling cap is hung over a dart in the dartboard. And I've angled the camera so you can't see the mess on the floor.
Anyway, this is the part of the podcast where we do turn our attention to the news and coronavirus, COVID-19, and how it's affecting things, when we might get racing again. And there has been news every week. What's the latest this week, Lionel?
Well, the latest and biggest news, I guess, is that the French President Emmanuel Macron announced at the weekend that there'll be no public gatherings in France until at least mid-July. So
Major public gatherings.
So we're just wondering and waiting to see if that means the inevitable postponement of the Tour de France, which of course is due to start in late June, hasn't been postponed as we speak. We just don't know yet, do we? We're hearing, there's been media reports of rejigged calendars, but until we know some fixed dates and until we know whether those fixed dates are feasible, it just feels a little bit previous. I certainly don't want to write things off, but nor do I want to get too giddy at the idea that we're going to all be back to normal in what would be sort of 2.5 months from now. I don't know how you read that, Daniel.
Well, first of all, I've never seen you giddy, but I would quite like to, as a sort of social experiment. Absolutely. I mean, we can only reiterate what we've said on that score, that speculation is more than ever redundant. We've been hearing for several weeks that the teams are really insistent that they need a month's notice before any Tour de France. They need racing to start a month before any kind of Tour de France. That mid-July cutoff point, you would think that some kind of communique announcement is in the pipeline from ASO to confirm that the race is going to be cancelled. Whether they actually provide any new dates, we don't know.
I think the strange thing about the kind of the reaction and the insistence that the tour must be cancelled and pushed back or whatever, it's a little bit strange because it's completely out of all of our hands, whether we are fans or media commentators or whatever. This is going to be a decision made by the French government, and they're not going to make a decision unless they're confident that the event can be held safely and ensure that it can reach a conclusion. Almost worse than postponing it or even cancelling it for the year is starting it and not being able to complete it. I think that would be more damaging for the tour. So it's kind of a decision that we're going to have to wait for the French authorities to make and then see whether that is a race run on a real kind of a minimal level with far fewer media there. I could certainly see a sort of an attempt at an almost behind closed doors type of event just to kind of pick up morale and get as part of the effort to get France back on its feet later on this year. But the speculation about whether or not things are going to go on and when they might go on and how the calendar might look, I as I've said repeatedly, it's kind of it's more wearying actually for me personally than the thought of just you know, discounting everything until we get something that is actually confirmed, and then we know what we're looking ahead to and working.
But hearing
towards.
You saying every week that you're not going to speculate about the, that's going to be that's more also wearying.
It's incredibly wearying. Yeah, I won't say it next week. I won't say that.
Yeah,
I won't say it. But it kind of feeds a certain anxiety. I think that the sense that. That we don't know, and I'd rather kind of not know.
The problem is at the moment we're all reading so many conflicting stories from experts about what's going to happen, because nobody knows, and so everybody's guessing. Some people with good information and some people not, but you know.
But ASO not cancelling the Tour de France until they absolutely have to is completely understandable. I mean, why would any
business voluntarily kind of close down without, you know, when you don't know what the situation is going to be in a couple of months? Nobody knows. So we're on a journey where we don't really know the destination. Hmm.
Until Emmanuel Macron and the French government and their authorities say this is not possible, then it has to remain... however slim, it has to remain a live possibility, doesn't it? Otherwise, what's the point of ASO unilaterally making its decision before it's had the full high-level consultations with the people who actually are making the decisions across the whole of the country? It kind of seems odd to me that it would be falling in ASO's lap to take a decision prematurely. Mm. But there we are. A short stop press to include some news that broke as we were finishing this week's episode. And I say this completely in the knowledge that it contradicts my point regarding the speculation about the rewritten race calendar and when races will be able to be held. But the French media today reported that the Tour de France has been penciled in to start on August the 29th. Meanwhile, Mauro Venni, the boss of RCS, told the Italian website Tutto Bici that his organisation is working only on one possibility regarding the Giro d'Italia, and that is to hold the race with fans, so not behind closed doors, so to speak. He also said that everyone's plans depend on what happens with the Tour de France, saying that if the Tour was to be reduced in length, the Giro would follow suit. As it stands, the plan is that the Giro would be held in October, with Milan-San Remo, Strada Bianca and Il Lombardia following on the 20th, 28th and 31st of October. But, of course, all of this is subject to change.
Any other news?
Some other news. Dylan Groenewegen has been delivering shopping for care workers and the elderly by bicycle. Of course, his team sponsor, Jumbo, is a supermarket chain. But Warren Barguil is going to be doing the same thing as
on
well.
On a bike so or a skateboard, as in I've the said, case of Warren Barguil. roller skates, actually.
Warren Barguil, yeah.
I apologise. Roller skates, that's his preferred.
I wonder how much FIFA Warren Barguil has been playing during lockdown. Quite interesting to know. The UCI has cut salaries for some of its staff seeking to cut costs. British Cycling has furloughed staff or is planning to furlough staff as well. So the economic impact is being felt across the sport from the top down, from the sports governing body and obviously the British governing body. There are some good news. A bit like Groenewegen and Barguil doing their rounds on a... What sort of bike are they going to use? I guess their own bike with some kind of luggage. But Ineos have pledged to deliver 1 million bottles of hand sanitizer to the NHS each month free of charge. Geraint Thomas is doing 3 charity rides of 12 hours each on Zwift to raise money for the NHS, basically mirroring an NHS worker's 12-hour shift. Specialised in the US are giving essential workers a free bike. There's been some racing as well. Rowan Dennis won the Ineos-only race on Zwift's platform using the Alpe de Zwift, which is a simulation of Alpe d'Huez. And Ashley Moorman-Passio won the Trofeo Bologna. I don't know why I pronounced that in Italian, because it was on Zwift. What's the language of Zwift? I don't know. Have I pronounced that correctly in Zwiftish? It was on the San Luca climb, though, where the Giro's prologue took place last year, a virtual version, of course. and Lou Bates was second, and Ella Harris was third. You may have heard Ella talking to Mitch Docker in Mitch's latest Life in the Peloton episode. If you haven't, go and check that out. Ella Harris won the Zwift Academy a couple of years ago, and as a result got a contract with the Canyon SRAM team. So, oh, and the other thing, the Giro charity ride with some of the greats of the Giro, Claudio Chiappucci, Mario Cipollini, Gianni Bugno, and Filippo Pozzato, undisputed legend of Italian cycling. Took place over the weekend as well.
Yeah, Ciro and I had a good laugh about that because we were quite concerned about whether Pozzato was actually going to be able to finish the 38 virtual kilometres, but we established that it was slightly downhill, so we thought he'd probably get on okay, and he did.
Just on the Ineos manufacturing and delivering hand sanitizers, they've also been doing that in Germany and France, and I gather Dave Brailsford has been coordinating a lot of that. I was in touch with him last week, so we're going to hear from him on the podcast soon.
Hello, it's Orla Shinawy here, and I'm interrupting this podcast to tell you about the new episode of the cycling podcast Femina, in which Rose Manley, Richard Moore and I discuss all the latest in women's cycling. We hear from Boels Dolman's rider Jip van den Bos about bike packing in lockdown, or trying to at least. We speak to the coach behind Annemiek van Vleuten and Marianne Vos, Louis de la Haya, including how he came to work with riders who are friends but also rivals. And we have an interview with Elise Chabet, the Big Le Catoosha professional who finished her medical studies last October and has gone to work in a local hospital in Geneva to help people suffering with COVID-19. Finally, Rose spoke to Molly Weaver about an event that she's putting on while we're in lockdown in her back garden. Instead of the Dirty Reaver, which she was supposed to do, this is the Dirty Weaver. Never miss an episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina by subscribing to the Cycling Podcast.
You mentioned, Lionel, that a few, well, governing bodies, UCI, have been reducing staff pay, furloughing staff as well. And that's been the case in a few teams as well. I think you mentioned that last week. One of the teams affected, Mitchelton Scott, staff and riders have had pay cut by up to 70% there. I spoke last week to Jack Haig, their rider who started the season extremely well and had big plans, big ambitions this year, about that. And the what he had to say was quite interesting about the effect on morale of having a pay cut.
It's definitely gotten harder since we had that news, because it's a difficult one to speak about, because I guess we don't really know at the moment what the financial situation is. Like, we understand it's bad, but we don't fully have an understanding of how it is, so it's quite hard to comment on it. But it has become harder since we were told this, because before the cuts had been put in place, I've always been someone that has thought, like, cycling is my job, so I'm going to work as hard as possible in my job to do that. And when you sort of have an agreement to a certain salary, then you kind of hold yourself accountable to that. And I was trying to be incredibly professional, sort of trying to stay in a relatively good weight range, try and be a lot more on the bike and quite focused. And sort of the motivation for this period was like a professional motivation to do well at my job. Whereas now with the salary cuts being so drastic, it's kind of taken away a little bit more. And now my motivation to ride the bike or stay fit is more of a personal sort of mental sanity and general wellness motivation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That does make absolute sense. While the commitment is there from the team and the sponsors, then your commitment is there too. Whereas, you know, it's like a contract, isn't it, between you and your team. Yeah.
And like, I don't want to portray the wrong image there. It's not like I'm now all of a sudden sitting on a sofa watching Netflix 11 hours a day eating Ben & Jerry's. I think even if I wasn't a professional cyclist, I'd still want to be quite a fit and active, healthy person. And I'm still going to return to racing in a very fit way, but just the motivation, the way that I've thought about it has changed a little bit.
So that was Jack Haig. I thought that was quite interesting, what he said about how it sort of subtly changes the motivation. I mean, all the, you know, most top bike riders are very self-motivated anyway, and the drive comes from within. But part of the deal is that you're paid by your team, by your sponsors, to do the job as well. That's the contract you have with them. And, you know, if they don't, for, you know, albeit perhaps perfectly justifiable, understandable reasons, a lot of businesses are going through a hard time at the moment. If they can't fulfill their end of the bargain, it does sort of subtly alter the relationship, I would imagine. And the other difficulty for the riders, of course, is not knowing what they're training for. Jack Haig as well, if anybody follows him on social media, they'll have seen that he, certainly in the early days of the lockdown, was asking a lot of questions on Twitter about using his trainer and going on Zwift and so on. Obviously not a regular. I spoke to him a bit about that too, and he said, you know, that there are some riders, and we saw Rohan Dennis win the Ineos Zwift race. He's probably, as a time trialist, used to making steady, hard, sustained efforts in one position, whereas climbers maybe aren't, and they struggle more with that kind of training. You know, that's going to perhaps, you know, I think he's got into the meetups and the social aspect to riding. I know Ashley Moomin-Passio, who you mentioned there, has been doing a lot of that kind of thing as well. She's a climber too. So riders are having to make adaptations, and it's not all plain sailing, I don't imagine.
Yes, Chaps. I mean, it will suit some people better than others, won't it? For some guys who are very sort of focused on just the physical exercise of riding and, you know, can sort of geek out with the numbers and so on, it might not be too jarring. But there are others. I mean, Thibaut Pinot, as we've mentioned him in the last few weeks, he's just this sort of typical kind of soul rider who, you know, is very much into, a bit like Jack Haig actually, being out in the open and out in nature and you know, this sort of almost symbiotic relationship with the land and the mountains. And it's a key source of inspiration, and it's a key reason why these guys, particularly climbers, I think, and ride bikes, that, you know, they enjoy that dimension of the sport. Just on Pino, there was a good quote a few days ago from Mark Madio, his team manager, just about training and not training over the next few months. He said that if you don't train for one day, you're the only person who notices it. If you don't train for a week, your coach starts to notice it. If you don't train for 2 weeks, then everyone will start to notice it. And I suppose that's the sort of dilemma that a lot of the riders are facing at the moment.
Yeah, Zwift and other computer simulated versions of races, they're not really the place for the whimsical flaneurs, are they? The people who tend to dwell at the back of the peloton just waiting to make their move. There's not a lot of opportunity for sort of coasting. It's just a numbers game. And I suppose that was the one takeaway from the what was it? It wasn't even there was only one team taking part in the Team Ineos race on Zwift. It was a bit like I don't know what it was a bit like.
A bit like Wembley with no goalkeeper. Headers and volleys with no goalkeeper.
Yeah, or kind of sports at school where it's just your own form of playing. There's no, you know, no competitive element other than competing against your own team.
Maybe a glimpse into an apocalyptic future when Ineos are the only cycling team.
Yeah, when team size has to be expanded to 180 to accommodate the one team that's left. But I gather there was supposed to be a bit more to and fro on the Alpe du Zwift race among the Ineos riders, try to make it a bit more interesting for spectators. But when you've got a time trialist like Rohan Dennis, it's not going to just not give it everything, I guess. And I suppose that highlighted that there isn't a lot of room for the finesse of road racing, or the sandbagging, or the rope-a-dope tactics. It's just who's putting out the most watts according to their weight. That's basically it, isn't it? I mean, you know, not knocking that. There's a place for it, and at the moment, I can see why it's popular. But would have been interesting to have seen a little bit of a storyline evolve over the course of the event, rather than just one person riding as hard as possible from start to finish. It's sort of Eddie Merckx-esque in its way.
Yeah, I've just on the subject of indoor trainers and homemade trainers, and Daniel, we had an email from Charlotte Steen, who her 8-year-old grandson has indeed made a homemade trainer, not with wine bottles, but with training shoes. She sent us a picture of this contraption. It certainly means that he can, well, I think he can ride away and not move. I'm trying to figure it out. I've got a photograph here. I'll forward it on to you.
I bet Graham O'Bree could knock up a mean turbo trainer out of some, I don't know, used Nespresso capsules and, you know.
Our iron brew bottles.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm sure he could. Just before we wrap things up for this week, couple of things to tell you. New episodes. Cycling Podcast Femina came out end of last week. That's got an interview in it with Elise Shabby, the doctor on Bigla Katusha, who's gone back to working in her local hospital in Geneva, helping patients with COVID-19. We also hear in that episode from Louis Delahaye, the coach who used to be on the Rabobank team for many years. He now coaches Annemiek van Vleuten and Marina Vos. He took over her coaching last year, had great results with her. Really interesting. That's a two-parter. We'll hear the rest of the interview with him in next month's episode. And Lionel, there was a new episode of Explore that landed yesterday.
Indeed, yes. Myself and Hannah Troop with the regular guest appearance from Ian Boswell. The main thrust of this episode focuses on the Three Peaks cyclocross race, featuring contributions from 3-time winner Nick Craig and 21-time veteran of the event Simon Scarsbrook and Lachlan Morton of EF Pro Cycling, who rode it for the first time last year and finished fourth. We'll probably put slightly tidied up versions of all three of those interviews because we could only use so much in the episode, but we'll put the full interviews with those three people on our website towards the end of this week, and we'll tweet about that so that if anyone wants to hear any of those three people talking about the Three Peaks, then they can do so. And well, there was a lot of good material that didn't make the cut, so they'll be worth listening to, I think.
And a reminder that if you want to listen to our new episode Vanderpool, for friends of the podcast, sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And we're still sending out books. My post office is open. I've got a big bag of books here, some of them signed, some of them purchased on through our website. So if you fancy a copy of our book, The Grand Tour Diaries, you can get one by becoming a friend or through the website.
Could be a slim volume this year, couldn't it? Who knows what we're going to do for our book?
There'll be a book, don't you worry.
It'll be a bit like the cover of the latest edition of Vogue, I think. All white. Rich, you mentioned Louis Delahaye there, very well thought of Dutch coach. Did you know that Adrie van Diemen is back in the World Tour Peloton? He's I noticed the other day that he's been signed up by UAE Emirates.
Former he's been coach around for a long time.
Greg LeMond and Dan Martin, among others.
Before we go, some thanks to those of you or some of you who signed up as friends of the podcast. My thanks to Giles Clark, Paul Weaver, Simon David, Rob Ainsworth, Nicholas Day, Alexander Croft, Christopher Ridge, Paddy Dunn, Andrew Cook, and Nicole Kett.
And a big thank you to Stephen Litterick, Martin Andrew, Neil Farron, Bradley Thordarson, James Twist, Eric Geyer, Peter Gagan, Eric Nestus Matheson, Jonathan Barrow and Tom Naylor.
And big thanks from me to Richard Corbett, David Peach, Stephen Potter, Gregor Graham, Scotty McMorrin, Glenn Walker, Adam Shoup, Alison Smith, Jeremy Milne and Patricia Amberg.
Thanks, Daniel.
Okay. Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Lionel.
Thank you. I'm giddy for my lunch now. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.